From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Going Valley.
We are from Hayward.
We're from the Inner Sunset.
I live in the Inner Sunset.
I live in Sausalito.
Coming up, we'll find out firsthand how elementary school students in Berkeley practice staying safe from an armed intruder.
I really credit the district and the board for prioritizing school safety and not sticking our heads in the sand, so to speak, and saying it can't happen here.
And we'll hear how a local rhythm and blues legend got her start in the clubs of the Fillmore District.
And I flew in the door and said, "Hey, you guys, I got a hit." They said, "What?" They looked at me like I was crazy. "You got a what?"
That's today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Every time news of another school shooting hits the headlines, so does the debate about how to keep children safe. After the shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary in 2012, the Berkeley Unified School District posed this question: how prepared are we to protect our students and staff against someone with a gun? And then, because this is Berkeley, they also ask, how do we balance security and privacy and civil rights?
Almost immediately after Sandy Hook, entering into discussions of, we need to do something. We can't just think that this is on the other side of the country and fortunately it didn't happen here. We also immediately began hearing from parents saying, we are scared. We want the district to do something. We're scared for our children.
This year, the Berkeley School Board adopted new safety measures that will protect students from an armed intruder, or so they hope. Ryan Miller has the story.
America's worst school shootings are so infamous that they've become a part of our common vocabulary. Virginia Tech, Sandy Hook. Each name is a catchword for terror, a wound that never heals. And then there's Columbine, the name of a lock on all the doors at Realm Charter School in Berkeley.
Okay. So we're opening the door, and when I close it, just press the lock in, and it's locked, and no one can get in unless they have a key.
It's been 15 years since two heavily armed students opened fire at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. California only recently passed a law requiring all newly constructed public schools to install Columbine locks, like this one in Nancy Williams' office.
It means safety for me. It means that if I'm in the office and someone's outside of the office and wants to get in, that they can't unless I allow them in, especially if they're a threat.
But elsewhere in Berkeley, many other schools still don't have upgraded security hardware in place. But not for long. The Berkeley Unified School District recently approved a safety plan that, like the Columbine locks, is a response to recent incidents of school gun violence.
And I really credit the district and the board for prioritizing school safety and not, sticking our heads in the sand.
Susan Craig is Director of Student Services for the Berkeley Unified School District. The memory of the Sandy Hook massacre is still very raw for her and for the parents she speaks to.
The impetus was the wake-up call of the Sandy Hook tragedy and the reality that it can happen anywhere.
Craig led a team of safety consultants and the Berkeley police on a tour of district schools, all 21 of them.
They really recommended a very, very high level of measures, everything from updating our public address systems to armed intruder training for all staff.
Craig's team rejected some ideas as too extreme for Berkeley, like having police with guns on every campus. But they began armed intruder training this summer, where staff learned to stop shooters in their tracks.
There's training around how to actually take the person down.
The $2 million plan includes installing Columbine locks in every classroom and upgrading loudspeaker systems. The school board also approved camera surveillance in all schools, pending the adoption of a privacy policy. That said, teachers are still taught the best response to an armed intruder is to go into lockdown. Here at LeConte Elementary, I'm walking upstairs to join Pamela Diebel and her class of second graders for a lockdown drill. Some passing students give me a quick preview of what to expect.
What we do is we close the blinds and we stay quiet.
And we lock the doors so, like,
and the teacher's not allowed to open the door.
And the teacher's not allowed to open the door.
And we have to stay really quiet.
Yeah.
Neptune is made of mostly of gas.
What about Uranus?
Up in her classroom, Ms. Diebel finishes her lesson about the solar system and explains more about the lockdown procedure, which happens 3 times a year.
We shut all the doors and windows, turn off the lights so that we can be as inconspicuous as possible, and the kids all come close to me on the carpet, and I just read a story to keep them calm.
Staff, this is a lockdown drill. Thank you.
So all the children are putting their chairs in, and they're going over to the carpet area where the teacher is making sure everybody's there. She has just gone out to lock the door from the outside. It's a little bit dark, but the children are gathered around the teacher as she reads a story.
You, J.K. Barker people, really know your stuff. I should have come here last year, and I'm going to come here next year. She frowned her disapproval. Daisy was indignant.
The lockdown is released. I repeat, the lockdown is released. Thank you, everybody. You did a fantastic, fantastic job.
LeConte principal, Veronica Valerio, thinks the lockdown drill went pretty well today, but she's operating under a lot of handicaps. For one thing, the school's PA system is so weak that her drill announcement wasn't heard through some parts of the school. The classrooms won't have Columbine locks until next year. Security cameras are also on the way.
I had no information whatsoever to even share with the staff, so in my mind, I just had to make sure that everybody was secured.
It was scary for the students, too.
I was kind of freaked out because it hasn't happened to me before, so it was kind of scary to have it so dark.
Lockdowns, cameras, armed intruder training. Berkeley has changed along with the rest of America. On the playground, I asked parents about the new security measures.
My name is Christina Sanders, and I have a little girl in kindergarten. Having armed personnel at the schools, that's not something that I would be in favor of.
My name is Ivan Brand, and my little boy is in second grade. Cameras would be great. I don't know about locking the doors.
Hi, my name is Wiley Manns, and my child's in second grade. And you never know. You just say, not my daughter's school. But you just never know. But the guns, definitely no arm. Police, no.
How safe is safe enough? It's a question that troubles Susan Craig. How much security would be too much for Berkeley? And how do you protect the innocence of childhood?
The philosophy, the idea that in Berkeley is we don't want our schools to become jails. We don't want a razor wire fence around our schools. We don't want to have metal detectors at the entrances.
At a time when shootings and stabbings seem to happen for no reason, Craig admits that, in the long run, piling on more and more security won't necessarily keep an armed intruder from hurting her students.
The individuals who did the Columbine shooting, the individual who did the Sandy Hook shooting, a metal detector would not have stopped those individuals.
In the end, says Craig, keeping Berkeley schools safe from outside danger starts with making them safe on the inside. And that's where the teachers and principals come in. One well-trained, quick-thinking staff member could save lives and keep Berkeley's reputation for nonviolence intact. In Berkeley, I'm Ryan Miller for Cross Currents.
We'd like to hear what you think of the Berkeley Unified School District's plan for safety in schools. Call our feedback line at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. This is the voice of Umpalaya Marcima Balinton. Raised in the 1940s and 50s San Francisco, since she was a kid, she loved to sing. By age 18, at just 85 pounds and a size 3 shoe, she was competing in and winning talent shows up and down Fillmore Street. But it was the Ellis Theater talent show that launched her into stardom. Her first hit in 1959 rose to number 3 on the Billboard charts. Her songbook contains more than 100 compositions. She opened for James Brown for 2 years and sang with greats like Etta James. Crowds have demanded her signature backflip, and she got a stage name, Sugar Pie DeSanto. Now at age 78, living in Oakland and still performing, DeSanto joined me in studio to talk about her beginnings in rhythm and blues.
I just used to do talent shows when I was coming up in San Francisco at these theaters. And by my luck, Johnny Otis discovered me in, singing at this theater, the talent show, and he picked me up from there, you know.
You remember that day?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about it.
I remember that. Nothing. He was in the theater hunting talent. He always searched for talent, you know. And I just kept on winning and kept on singing, and finally he just offered me a recording.
And he was the one who named you Sugar Pie?
Yes.
How did that happen?
I couldn't very well use my real name on a record.
Which is?
Umpalaya. Filipina.
Umpalaya.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I couldn't use that. So he just said, well, you're a little bitty thing. You're only 3'2". So I think I'll call you Sugar Pie. You're cute little, you know what I'm saying? That's how it came about. He named me, you know.
Did you grow up in a musical household? Or?
Yes. My mother was a concert pianist. And she taught me a lot, you know. She would play classics and have me sing them, you know. And I better not go wrong or else,
uh-oh,
if you know what I mean. I was under the ruler. And it just went from that, you know, my love for music from my mother, I'll say.
And so you went on to the talent shows at what age then?
Oh, my goodness. What? 15, you know, that was back the talent days. But then I did later on, as I was getting older, you know, that I still was around the Bay Area going, sneaking in the little clubs and, you know, singing. If my father caught me, he'd kill me, you know. But my mom would let me go, you know, because she knew I loved the music, and I told her that's what I wanted to be, you know. So she let me sneak around, and sometimes he'd tell a fib to my father, you know. Well, where is she? Oh, I don't know. She's probably at her, you know, girlfriends or whatever. She'd vouch for me, you know. She'd lie, in other words. So I just grew up around music.
Were there many women in music at that time doing what you were doing?
Not in the Bay Area. Most of the ones that I did know, they were dancers, you know. They were dancing more than singing, like exotic dancers. Friends of mine, you know, grew up with. So, no, not too many.
Hmm. So you chose singing rather than kind of going the way of many of your friends. Why? What is it about singing for you?
That's hard to explain. It's just a feeling that you get. You could be feeling down in the dumps, but a song can pick you up, you know. Maybe not for long, but if you release the tension or whatever it is that's bothering you, you can sing it away. Take my word.
Ow! Doo-doo!
What is the significance of singing your own words and your own music versus somebody else's? What is it for you? What is the power?
To me, I just think I'm in a better, I can produce it better, you know, my own music. I'm not against their music, but I just feel that I could do a better job within doing my own music, you know, something I write. I really feel it, you know. Always pertain to my life and how I'm living it. That's the way I write, you know.
So
if
whatever.
You hear some of my songs, then you know, oh, well, she actually probably did that, you know. You can feel the power of it, I think. And I prefer my own music than anybody else's.
Hmm. Were there many producers at that time in San Francisco?
No. There was not. Most producers were in Oakland, like Bob Gettings, that recorded my first hit record, you know, in 1959. He was a powerhouse during that time. I'd say Oakland, for producers, he was one of the best.
And what was that hit record?
I Want to Know. I Want to Know, 1959.
I want to know if you miss me. I want to know, would you still kiss me? Please don't start no stuff, cause I don't want to get rough. I want to know.
When I went in the studio the first time to bring them the tape to hear it that I made, you know, my manager, Jim Moore, he was there, too. And he was, you know, doing his business, whatever, with the producer, Bob Gettings. And I flew in the door and said, hey, you guys, I got a hit. They said, what? They looked at me like I was crazy. You got a what?
Treating me like a queen. No sooner I turn my back, yourself another woman and you done split the scene. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Please come back.
In 1964, you were the only female act to tour with the American Folk Blues Festival.
Yeah, in London.
Yeah, and I'm wondering what it was like to be the only woman on that tour with all of those male performers.
Miserable. Miserable.
How so?
Because I was the only woman and they were hitting on you, you know. I got kind of bored with them, you know, because I wouldn't go with any of them, you know. So, and they'd be pushing me and pressing me. I'm going to take Sugar Pie to dinner tonight. Oh, no, you're not. You know.
So that's what a woman performer had to deal with at that time?
Yes. Me, that I know of. I don't know about the other women, but I know what I had to deal with.
What are some of your most memorable performances?
The Apollo in New York.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about it.
With people like Patti LaBelle, Smoking Miracles, Gladys Knight, you know, all those greats. I've been there about, 18 times.
And you opened for James Brown.
Yes, I did. That's where he found me, at the Apollo.
How do you feel you've changed since the 60s and the 70s in terms of your music and your singing?
Oh, yeah. I haven't really changed, but I mean, you know, it's gets harder to do at my age, you know. After all, I'm 78, come on. But I still think I got a few left in me, you know.
I'm wondering how you feel when you get up on stage and sing. What do you feel?
That's how I soothe my nerves. You know, if I got anything on my mind or I have something to do that I didn't do or something that I needed to do or something made me mad or I don't feel good, you know, you have those bad days, you know. I just sing it away, you know, and get the most relief of any problems that I might have, you know, or worrying about. So, it's my life.
So it's the power of a song.
It's the power of the song, yes. Mm-hmm. And it can take you anywhere you want to go. You can be happy, sad. That's what music does.
Hello, San Francisco. We finally got a chance to meet.
That's local rhythm and blues legend Sugar Pie DeSanto. A film about her life called Bittersweet is in production, and you can see Sugar Pie perform this Sunday at the Stern Grove Music Festival in San Francisco. Details are all at klw.org. Click Cross Currents.
I knew someday that I would walk, that I would walk.
And that does it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Lawrence Chan, Ronnie Cohen, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Sandhya Dirks, Jeannie Dwan, Laura Flynn, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Holly McDeed, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, and Rachel Vasquez. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Our line producer was Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Our senior producers are Julie Kane and Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And thank you. We are listener-supported public radio. And we leave you today with the sounds of Sugar Pie DeSanto. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. Don't need your love, so don't touch. Hands on.